From the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, this is Voices of Public Intellectuals. I'm your host, Florence Ladd. This week's program features Linda Gordon, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin and winner of the Gustavus Myers Human Rights Award for her 1994 book, Pitied But Not Entitled, Single Mothers and the History of Welfare. Professor Gordon is speaking on the Great Arizona Orphan Abduction, Women, Race, and Citizenship on the Mexican Border. Here to introduce Professor Gordon is Dr. Tamar March, Dean of Educational Programs.
It is once again my pleasure to welcome you all on behalf of the Graduate Consortium on Women's Studies and Radcliffe Seminars, and to introduce to you our lecturer tonight. Linda Gordon is professor of history at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and this year she is at New York University. She is an expert on women's social history in the United States, examining the historical roots of contemporary social policy debates, particularly as they concern gender and family issues. The quality of her work has been widely recognized. She is the recipient of fellowships ranging from the Guggenheim, the American Council of Learned Societies, and the Ford Foundation. She was a Bunting Fellow, and so we, of course, are welcoming home one of our own alumni. Linda holds a bachelor from Swarthmore and a PhD from Yale University. Her 1994 book, Pitied But Not Entitled, Single Mothers and a History of Welfare, received both the Berkshire Prize for Women's History and a Gustavus Myers Human Rights Award. And her most recent book, published by Harvard University Press this past November, is entitled The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction, and it just received the Bancroft Prize. The title of her lecture tonight is, amazingly enough, The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction. Please welcome Linda Gordon.
When the posse arrived at Margarita Chacon's house, George Fraser, supervisor of the copper smelter, banged on the door with the butt of his Winchester. Neville Leggett, the only member of the posse who actually knew Margarita, cringed. When she opened the door, he kept his hand away from his revolver, and he very much hoped the others would do likewise. Although it was already 11 p.m. and raining, Leggett knew exactly where to go because, he said, he knew every Mexican in North Clifton since he was delivery man for the company store. And he didn't think there would be any trouble for Margarita. She was familiar to most of Clifton, a schoolteacher who taught the Mexican kids in her own home, a devout woman who went to church every day, dressed entirely in black, her face hidden under her black shawl. Her husband Cornelio was a skimmer for the copper smelter, earning top wages for a Mexican. Fraser naturally did the talking for the posse. He said that she was to hand over the orphans the priest had given her. She asked if I had an order from the padre to take the child, but I said no. The citizens of the town demand the children back. These children were 4-year-old Jerome Shanley and 3-year-old Catherine Fitzpatrick, Irish Catholic orphans from New York. They had been shipped out to Arizona on an orphan train to their new home with Senora Chacon, as arranged by the padre. Fraser testified later, that is, at the trial, that she was very obliging and accommodating to the 4 armed men. But that was when he was trying to avoid the impression that the children had been taken by force. It's true that after they had waited in the wind and the rain a while, she invited them in, seeing that they were already carrying the 3 kids they had picked up from Francisco Alvidres and from Leah Wyndham's Mexican wife, whose name they didn't know. But Leggett didn't find Margarita so obliging and pointed out that she took 45 minutes to confer with her family and dress the two orphans before handing them over. In fact, he said, she was the only one who did not want to give up the children, as he also said that she was the only one who could speak English without seeing any connection between his two statements. Afterwards, they went to the home of Jose Bonillas, and so by the time they went back to the hotel, the four of them were carrying and pulling along six kids through the rain. This is the beginning of the book I wrote about an episode that took place in October 1904 in Clifton, Morenci, Arizona. It's a story of white vigilantes kidnapping orphans from their Mexican foster homes. I wrote the orphan story because I wanted to tell a tale, a narrative, as scholars now call it. Narrative history has gone in and out of favor over the last two centuries. It is not now what most historians do, and it is new for me. My previous work was History of Social Policy, in which I tried to understand how we got where we are today with regard to several controversial issues such as reproductive rights, child abuse and domestic violence, welfare. And I imagine I was invited to speak to you because of this previous policy-related work. Those who invited me probably had no idea about my most recent work and may have been puzzled when I said that this story was what I wanted to talk about. I chose this narrative genre as a break from previous writings to explore a new approach to public speech. It is too soon, I think, to tell whether it works. I decided to write this book for reasons scholarly, personal, and public. But after so many years as a historian, the scholarly and the personal have converged. I wanted the pleasure of exploring a new voice as a writer and the depth of understanding that is afforded by what we now call a microhistory. I enjoy the kind of close examination one can apply to a very small story precisely because it's small. Many of us have memories of history textbooks which we found boring, and we often thought that this was because they were too detailed. But there is detail and there is detail. Specificity can actually make history gripping, and for me anyway, detail is what's most fun to uncover. I had a lot of fun collecting the name and location of every small store in the town of Clifton in 1904. I pored over the 2,000 plus individuals in the 1900 census until I felt I knew every household. I was absolutely elated when one of my informants, I guess you call him, the 95-year-old fabulous raconteur Alfonso Fernandez, was able to recall for me the names of the songs that the Nickelodeon played in his favorite saloon. And I think I could write with much more confidence because I felt that I knew this town as well as it was possible to know a town a century later. But details also captivate me because of their narrative role in creating a sensuous environment and thereby drawing us into stories. Historians, they say, are noted murder mystery readers because we love plot. Perhaps more than character, even. Plot is about cause and effect and motive, which are, after all, what historians are always trying to figure out. We also like the complexity and occasionally the dim lighting of real stories, even the kind of film noir awareness that we have of how much must remain unknown. And in fact, I think historians often like this better than the more floodlit clarity of social science. Historians often like ambiguity, not precision. I like the way that in telling a story, each note in the score sounds reverberating overtones, sometimes not quite audible, but nevertheless sensed. Overtones different when played by different instruments, different in each performance, different possibly to each reader. So I like the fact that stories are open to interpretation. I can tell you that the orphan story is about race, about gender, about family, and more particularly about how family and gender define and maintain racial boundaries. I can tell you that it is very much about colonialism, that it is a reminder of the enormous power of great corporations. But of at least equal importance to me is that a story condenses meaning. A good story is both uniquely specific and inclusively universal. It works through its density, its multi-layered, multi-dimensioned symbolic structure. Through condensation, It can communicate information more swiftly, economically, and powerfully than through more formal analysis. So this is my public intellectual reason for writing this book, a hunch about telling a story as a way of talking about some of the great issues of turn-of-the-century America. Narrative is an intensely popular form, and I doubt that postmodern writing will displace it. So-called human interest stories occupy a very large place in our public discourse, and we often argue about politics through publicized personal conflicts. We did this about Anita Hill, about O.J. Simpson, about Baby M. Today we are doing it about Elian Gonzalez, the Cuban boy. Stories often do the work of abstract public debate. Most Americans have observed the TV ratings of the O.J. Simpson case and have participated in discussions of sexual harassment and racism in the form of debates about that verdict. Every teacher who has ever given students a quantified piece of social knowledge, such as the evidence against the claim that welfare encourages childbirths, has gotten responses from students like, "But my mother's downstairs neighbor had two more children just to collect welfare." I wonder if, rather than responding with more statistics, it might be more effective to encourage interrogating such folkloric anecdotes through narratives that offer a whole picture of a welfare life, complete with motives, constraints, rational and irrational decisions. Writing this narrative was, in a sense, an attempt to speak to someone just like that student, and just possibly for some of those debating, for example, the case of Elian Gonzalez today, recognizing that for many people, stories and individuals impart more understanding than generalizations. Now, in writing this way, I am being in some small way unconventional as a scholar, but also following a very hallowed tradition in history. Traditionally, no scholarly discipline has commanded a more popular audience than history. In the 19th century, historians laureates such as Thomas Carlyle were read by a very broad segment of the educated public. Today, his place might be said to be taken by someone like, for example, Steve Ambrose. These men write beautifully, and they tell no minor stories, but the grand, founding, mythical, allegorical stories of a nation. Carlyle wrote about the French Revolution, about the establishment of parliamentary government in England, and literally about the heroic in history. Stephen Ambrose has written about Eisenhower, about Lewis and Clark, about Thomas Jefferson, about D-Day. Recently, even an Indian, Crazy Horse, made it into Ambrose's pantheon in the context of his epic battle with Custer. Ambrose is a historian in that great 19th century tradition. His work designed to evoke patriotism and community among those who fit comfortably into what is sometimes called mainstream America. Even if I had his skill, it would be harder to speak to a broad public about America's internal conflicts, its injustices. Worse, even if I had his skill, the stories I'm drawn to seem to lack the clarity of heroism and the conquest of evil. In fact, the stories I like, and the story in this book, have much to do with the imperfection of all human judgments. So let me now quickly tell you a little more of this story, mainly summarizing, very occasionally reading little snippets from the book so you can see what I mean. The story started in New York City. There in the 19th century, child welfare advocates developed a system of rescuing, as they called it, the city's so-called orphans by shipping them out west on orphan trains. I put voiced quotation marks around orphans because most of these children were not what we call orphans today. They were mostly children of poor single mothers who could not manage to support their children. The so-called rescuers were motivated partly by sympathy for the children, also by a desire to combat disorder and violations of proper family values among the poor, to rid the city of undesirables, to avoid spending tax money on the poor. The child savers also believed in a West in which rural life would discipline the depraved urban poor and in which the frontier would provide opportunity for upward mobility that the city lacked. As you will see, the child savers got just what they wanted with these orphans, though not in the way they expected. Most of these orphans were Catholics, while the leading child savers in New York were Protestants who placed the waifs in Protestant homes. To the Catholics, this policy seemed a form of religious genocide. In response, the Irish Sisters of Charity opened a large Catholic home for abandoned children known as the New York Foundling Hospital. The Foundling, as it was called, ran its own orphan trains, placing children in Catholic homes in the West. So in 1904, a priest in two small towns, Clifton and Morenci, Arizona, rounded up parishioners to volunteer to take 40 orphans. A group of kids aged 2 through 6 was shipped out, accompanied by 3 Sisters of Charity, 3 nurses, and 1 male logistics agent. The priest and a large crowd of curious townspeople, mainly women, met the train when it arrived a week later on October 1st in Clifton. The priest and some of his women parishioners packed the kids into hacks and took them to the small adobe Sacred Heart Church. There the children sat, fidgeting on the pews, as women lined up, one after another, handing a slip of paper bearing the name and number of their assigned child to the priest. He led the children, one by one, to their new mothers, who led them to their new homes. But the New York Catholics did not understand that the Clifton-Morenci Catholics were, of course, Mexicans. Even had the New Yorkers known this in advance, they might have considered that piece of information irrelevant, because what was important to them above all was that the foster families had been vetted by the priest, who pronounced them all good Catholics of upstanding morality, living in clean and orderly homes. The New Yorkers would have described these orphans as being of the Irish race, while in Arizona they had become simply Anglo. Because something unexpected had happened to these orphans as they crossed the country. They became white. In Arizona, the Irish, the Germans, the Slavs, the Jews were Anglos, just as somewhat later and more gradually they became white in New York. So this trip to the wide open West fulfilled the child savers' hope for a better future for the kids, a white future. I picture their train puffing along, crossing rivers, then mountains, then the desert, then climbing up to this remote mile-high mining camp, carrying 40 poor orphans to whiteness. Now, these twin towns, Clifton and Morenci, had arisen around copper mines and smelters, and their combined population of somewhere between 4,500 and 5,000 about this time was about 65 to 70% Mexican. In fact, the prosperity of this place was based on the copper company's ability to use Mexican workers for 65% the wages of white workers. The site was soon to become the leading copper producer in the territory and then in the United States, and today it remains the biggest gem in the Phelps Dodge Corporation's crown as one of copper's big four in the United States. So, the Anglo women of Clifton Morenci watched the distribution of the children with mounting outrage. Although they were standing right next to the nuns, the two groups of women saw entirely different events. The nuns saw Catholic children being placed with Catholic parents. The Anglo Clifton Morenci women saw white children being given to half-breeds, one of the kinder labels they used for Mexicans. They felt certain that placing these white kids with Mexicans was a barbaric act, and they began to convince their fellow citizens that the children needed rescue from child abuse. The Anglo women spread word of an emergency and organized an indignation meeting the next day at the Clifton Library, which had been a gift of the Copper Company and where Mexicans, of course, did not feel welcome. There, a large Anglo crowd listened to frenzied rhetoric about the scandal of placing white children in allegedly wretched, illiterate, depraved, immoral Mexican homes. And I was quoting, "Women demanded action. Men had to show their manliness, and 25 of them volunteered for a posse. These vigilantes, along with hundreds of armed and agitated Anglos, first massed in the central square of Morenci, where they threatened the nuns with pistols to their heads and brought out a rope with which they threatened the priest and the male agent of the orphanage. Charles Mills, manager of the mines for Phelps Dodge, explained in the understated voice of power, speaking as if his own decisions were the ineluctable laws of nature, that, and I quote, These people, that is, the Mexicans, were indigent, had no trade, no means, and didn't draw sufficient salary to support families or educate them neither. They didn't educate their own children. Five or six of them would stop in the same room, didn't even have a bed to sleep in. Yet Mills, of course, set the wage rates, which not only paid the Mexicans 60-some percent of an American wage, as they called it, for the same job, but reserved, of course, all the supervisory positions for Anglos. The mine manager did help prevent a lynching by distracting the crowd with another activity. The men formed a posse which divided into several groups, moved through the night to the Mexican adoptive homes, pounded on the doors, and seized the orphans at gunpoint. These vigilantes brought the children to the Clifton Hotel, where a group of Anglo women kept some for themselves and distributed others among the Anglos and refused to give them back to the foundling hospital. Having rescued the children, these Anglo women then set about building the defense they would use in court. They relied in part on anti-Catholicism. One of them was sure that 20 orphans had died en route to Clifton due to negligence. And it seemed, she said, that there were few limits to the Catholics' callousness. And I quote, some of the children were taken sick on the train and had been given to Indians along the latter part of the route in order that they might be got out of the way before dying. Several women agreed that the foundling regularly sold children like cattle in carloads, and that this was the way the Catholics periodically got rid of the illegitimate offspring of the nuns and the priests. But soon, the Anglo women's discussion fixed on Mexican inferiority, the men's drunkenness, and the mother's lack of virtue. They were all prostitutes, bar women, negligent mothers, and poor housekeepers. They are very illiterate people, Muriel Wright said, and they are not a cleanly class of people and spend nearly all their earnings in drinking and gambling. And those that earn anything at all, of course, it is just a mere pittance, not enough to clothe their own children. Given the typical domesticity and religiosity of the Mexican women, their reputation as tireless scrubbers, these accusations seem mysterious. The mystery unravels when the Anglo women were asked if they knew any Mexican women. Louisa Gatti, wife of a local butcher, described the adoptive mothers this way. They were dirty faces and they wore black shawls over them and they had ragged dresses on. Questioner, do you know these Mexican people who got these children? Do you know anything of them personally? Mrs. Gatti, no, sir. There are so many Mexican women around, I don't know one from the other. Most of the Anglo women later admitted that they did not know any of the Mexican women. Etta Reed claimed that she had gone to see two of the children in a Mexican home, but she didn't know which one. She didn't know whether it had a floor. None of them had been inside a Mexican home, but they knew what they were like. It is just like all the other Mexican homes. It is very rude. I wasn't inside the dwelling, but it was very coarse. It was built of lumber as well, I remember, but it might have been made of adobe. They all knew that the Mexican women's and children's clothing was hopelessly shabby and dirty, that they were personally dirty, and that their housekeeping was poor, although Mrs. Pasco made an exception for the woman who cleaned her own house, including the room where her husband worked at his undertaking business. When asked if she knew any Mexican women, Mrs. Wright said, I know of one that I have heard of. She has been a very bad woman, and she keeps a boarding house now, and her house is visited by the worst class of people in town. In fact, she boards them. Now, she was talking about Angela Flores, alleging that Flores was a prostitute. Mrs. Wright could not bring herself to say that word, but everyone knew what she meant. Her Victorian propriety, overlaid by racism, branded lower-class Mexican women as sexually loose, and Anglo women were just as implicated as Anglo men in the spread of this calumny. The fact that Flores was married to John Maxwell, himself the son of a mixed marriage, was part of what made her seem immoral to these Anglo women. It's possible that Mrs. Wright had some evidence of John Maxwell's alleged immorality. It wasn't easy for Anglo men to meet Mexican women, chaperoned and secluded as they usually were. So John might have met Angela in a bar or restaurant where she worked. Some Anglo women might well have considered such a public job, ipso facto, disrespectable. But Muriel Wright, whose husband owned a saloon where she herself served food and drink, not to mention her friend, One of the other leaders of the women, Laura Abraham, who had been a bar singer, still occasionally performed in her hotel bar and had a diamond set in one of her front teeth. Meanwhile, the nuns completely capitulated to the Clifton-Morency racial complaints. They said more or less, okay, we must have misunderstood, we made a mistake, we will take all the children back to New York, replace them with suitable white Catholics. But it was too late, because now the Anglos would not give up the children. So the family hospital brought suit, and the case made its way through three layers of court, ending in the United States Supreme Court in 1906. All of the courts ruled in favor of the vigilantes and allowed them to keep the children. The legal logic included several abstruse points, but the central finding, which is what I want to talk about here, rested on the best interests of the child doctrine. As the opinion said, and I'm quoting now from the Supreme Court, the child, in this case they're speaking about a singular child because each case was handled separately, the child was abandoned to the keeping of a Mexican Indian who was unable properly to feed, clothe, shelter, maintain, and educate said children, and who was otherwise, by reason of his race, mode of living, habits, and education, entirely unfit to have the care, control, custody, and education of said minor. For a short time, this case was notorious. It was covered in most national newspapers. The New York Times, true to its august traditions of even-handedness, condemned the vigilantes but praised the court decisions.
You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with this week's speaker, Linda Gordon.